Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming to this concert this evening. So the concert is recognizes the 2020 as the as a Beethoven year, if you will, because it celebrates or marks the 250th anniversary of his birth. I've never totally understood the anniversary fetish in concert life, but it is, it's been going on for a long time. It's not a modern invention, and in fact, these celebrations were often the occasion for important changes in both performance and scholarship. The 1928, for example, centenary of the death of Schubert was a milestone in research and interpretation of Schubert's life. In the case of Beethoven, Beethoven is probably, along with Mozart and Bach, the most well-known figure in the history of Western music. And he achieved what this concert tries to put into sound is the influence that he had on the subsequent music. So in contrast to some composers, he had an outsized influence on future composition. The late Harold Bloom, the literary critic, talks about the anxiety of influence and the process by which subsequent generations deal with the inevitable critical effort to find out the roots, who influenced them, whom did they borrow from, whom did they try to avoid, and how artists make the effort to, and writers in particular, to hide the tracks and try to evade the idea of being in the shadow of a predecessor. Beethoven cast a shadow that was unavoidable for the entire 19th century for subsequent generations. And I'll come back to why that was the case, and you can probably glean that from what you'll hear today. So it was not only Beethoven's musical, let's call it formal achievement, what he seemed to represent in the sounds and in the music that he wrote, but also there was a romantic image developed of Beethoven himself. In other words, his biography became embellished, or perhaps not embellished, but interpreted in a way that was extremely powerful for subsequent generations. The first major scholarly biography was, as I mentioned in the note I wrote in the program book, was written by an American, and Alexander Wheelock Thayer, and there was an obsession with his life by future generations. The things about his life that attracted future generations were a variety of illusions or cliches about Beethoven. One was that he was a rebel, that he was the first free artist, that he pushed back on authority, that he was irascible, impolite. I don't think anybody moved as many times in Vienna in a single lifetime as Beethoven, and infuriated as many landlords as Beethoven. And then, of course, the remarkable fact that he, for a large part of his career, was deaf. And and a kind of the artist is romantic hero, and it reaches its high point with the publication of the multi-volume biography novel, really, Jean-Christophe Baron-Romain Rolland, who won the Nobel Prize largely for that book, a fantastic novel about a composer, which is more evidently modeled on Beethoven. So Beethoven became an emblem of the romantic artist and as a larger-than-life person who was exempted from the constraints on behavior to which normal individuals are subjected. So the greatness of his artistry excused his manners, permitted him freedoms. This is the idea. In truth, Beethoven was still caught in an old system of patronage. After the 1815, after the end of the Napoleonic era, in the remainder of his life, the last 12 years of his life, he was relatively out of fashion, a legendary figure. His music was not en vogue. Rossini was en vogue. He was not, and he was not too pleased about it, and he threatened to move away, and a group of Viennese aristocrats created a fund and supported him. So he remained under the umbrella of aristocratic patronage. True, he earned money from commissions and beginning from publications. His career is at the very beginning of the 19th century pattern by which composers could earn an income from the publication of their music. The growth of the audience, the amateur audience, was just beginning. And so in that sense, he is a bridge figure between the economics and social conditions of the composer of the 18th century and the 19th century artist. And but he became, and of course, the myths about his love life or non-love life, the eternal beloved, and his frustration with that aspect of his life. He was not the republican that we always think of him as being. His model of a great political context was probably Joseph II, the enlightened monarch of the Habsburg Empire, under whose shadow, in a way, or in his reign, he was born into. His Bonn teachers, the Bonn he grew up in was a liberal place, but in the 18th century, enlightened absolutism sense. Yes, inspired by the French Revolution, but and yes, offended by Napoleon's shift from a republican to becoming an emperor, but in the end, he's not a revolutionary politically. His library shows that he was interested in what would be called liberal political thought, but mostly in romantic philosophy, in literature and philosophy. And he tried, actually, to be considered a nobleman in the courts of Vienna. So the Van Beethoven, which is a Dutch, he tried to argue that he was not a commoner and deserved legal attention in the courts that were restricted to the aristocracy. Complicated figure. But the 19th century didn't want to know anything about that. The 19th century saw him as the free artist and the expressor of subjectivity and of independence and defiance against an increasingly mechanistic Philistine world. And he was an inspiration, absolute inspiration. The Schumann, for example, in his imaginary conversance and interlocutors, Florestan, Eusebius. Florestan comes from Fidelio, from the hero of his opera. Liszt made up the story, or his father did, about being kissed on the forehead by Beethoven. Probably never happened, but you know, it. The young Mendelssohn was completely entranced by the music of Beethoven, and he looked at the quartets of Beethoven as a model. The whole notion of artistic romanticism and the expression of subjective individuality and breaking norms and expectations, certainly, and trying to use music as a language of the infinite, beyond the constraints of reality, this was associated with Beethoven's music. So the concert today looks at that legacy. So the first composer is the oldest, that is to say, the overlapped with Beethoven, Louis Spohr, was a great violinist and a conductor and a composer of operas and a tremendous amount of music, and a fantastic violinist, and his school of violin playing is a Bible for people interested in how people used to play the violin and how violinistic technique was then and has evolved. He was somewhat critical of Beethoven. He was one of the people who thought that Beethoven's music was somehow lacked symmetry, lacked beauty, tried to cultivate the sublime, which was a little bit different from beauty, and was somehow imbalanced, certainly the late work of Beethoven. The late work of Beethoven had a long time in being absorbed into the concert repertory. A composer, a liturgical composer, who was the director of the Vienna Conservatory in the mid-19th century. This is an anecdote repeated by Karl Goldmark, the Austro-Hungarian, the Hungarian composer of the Queen of Sheba, very wonderful composer, was a student in the conservatory. It must have been around 1850, around the time the Liszt piece we're going to hear today was premiered, and Prior was rehearsing, the director of the Ninth Symphony, and told the student orchestra that they shouldn't pay too much attention to the piece because Beethoven had lost his marbles, and this was just crazy music. So you have to understand that what was popular about Beethoven in his lifetime, let's say Louis Spohr's lifetime, was not the Beethoven we cherish. It's not Opus 131. It's the ruins of Athens, which nobody hears anymore. The tunes you'll hear that Liszt has a fantasy on are the popular tunes of Beethoven in the 19th century. So it's not the late piano sonatas, but the Pathetique, the Appassionata, the Waldstein, it's Opus 13, Opus 59 quartets. It's middle period Beethoven, the fifth, the third symphony, the seventh, the pastoral, particularly the pastoral symphony. So Spohr was sufficiently younger than Beethoven that he already came of age thinking that there is a musical past that has to be communicated to an audience that defines what the musical future will look like or sound like. It's the first time there's a self-consciousness of a classical or historical heritage, where a new generation thinks, I'm part of a history, and that history is very important to how I define myself. And the symphony we're doing is fascinating in this regard because he actually puts into sound a history textbook. So what you would go to school and learn that there was a Baroque period and it was dominated by Bach and Handel. Then there was a classical period and there was Haydn and Mozart. And then there was Beethoven and then the young Romantics. So that you have get an exam on that, you go to classes, you read it in the textbook and all that. Forget the textbook. He wrote a symphony of four movements which tells you everything you want to know about that. So the symphony opens with Bach. Then there's an interlude which is Handel. Then it comes back to Bach. Then the second movement is Haydn and Mozart. And the scherzo is Beethoven. And then the last movement is Our Times, which is a mixture of Italianate, Mendelssohn, sort of Weber. It's a little bit, modern times, we're talking about the 1830s. So 10 years after, almost 10 years after Beethoven's death. So this is a fascinating history lesson, beautifully written and beautifully constructed, about the stylistic development which now he considers himself standing in. It's like building a railroad. So there, you don't know where the railroad is going if you have one station. But once you have three stations, four stations, it has a direction. And he says, those are the previous stations, that's our station here. Chronologically, the second piece on the program is the one after intermission, and that is Liszt's fantasy on the themes from the ruins of Athens. I have to apologize, there's a kind of a misprint here. If you look at your program, it looks like this was written in 1808 by Liszt, 2 years before, 3 years before he was born. This is not a prenatal composition. This is not some kind of religious miracle. No. The piece actually, it says, thank God, when it was premiered, which is 1853, it was actually written around the time of the Beethoven celebration where they erected a statue of Beethoven. Even books have been written on the statuary of Beethoven in Europe. There's a very famous one in Vienna. There are several in all over. And how Beethoven was presented, the most famous of all was the fantastic idealized sculpture of Beethoven by the artist Max Klinger, which is now in the Gewandhaus in Leipzig, but was exhibited in the Vienna Secession in the early part of the 20th century, and Klimt did murals surrounding the one piece of art inside the Secession exhibition space, which was this multicolored marble of somehow Beethoven is an Olympian god with fantastic symbolic iconography around it. It's a fantastic piece of work, and it really exemplifies the image of Beethoven, the heroic and overwhelming presence of Beethoven, and Klimt's murals around. Actually, Gustav Mahler did a small orchestration of an extract from the Ninth Symphony for the opening of that exhibition. But one of the first statues of Beethoven was in his birthplace, and Liszt and Louis Spohr collaborated on a festival, a Beethoven festival in the 1840s, which was designed to raise money for this bust, or this statue of Beethoven that was going to be put up. And so he chose these very famous tunes from the ruins of Athens to write a fantasy. He did a lot of that for operatic material, and he chose this as well. The Ruins of Athens is a work that has fallen out of the repertory. Richard Strauss did his own version of it. He tried to revive it as well. But it was really one of the canonic works for the 19th century appreciation of Beethoven. So this gives you a sense of Liszt's sense of Beethoven and his elaborations about on the piano reflect Beethoven's influence as a composer for the instrument. Beethoven tried through his career to expand the range of the piano as the piano's technology developed. So the Emperor Concerto, for example, was for a different instrument than, let's say, the C minor piano concerto. And therefore, it was a longer range. He could do more things with it. The piano in the 19th century was like the computer or the smartphone today. You know, there's computer, the iPhone 4 and iPhone 6 and iPhone, where the piano, there was a piano 4 and a piano 6. And it developed all through the 19th century. And Liszt was a big, he got involved with various piano manufacturers as a kind of, not a salesman, but promoting them. And Beethoven was certainly a composer of the piano who was conscious of the technology of the instrument he was writing for and what it could do. And you'll see in this fantastic performance by our pianist today that he Liszt is fully cognizant of the possibilities of the modern piano as an expressive and varied instrument. And this is something he also picks up from Beethoven. He's also famous for having transcribed the symphonies for the solo piano. And for him, Beethoven was the dominant defining figure for his own musical career. And like Beethoven, he was a composer and a virtuoso pianist, which Beethoven was, and gave up that as his hearing deteriorated. The third piece on the program is by Max Reger in chronology. Now, Max Reger, in the year 1900, if you had asked who were the greatest composers of Central Europe, in German-speaking Europe, or in Central Europe in general, people would have said Richard Strauss first, and then probably Max Reger before Gustav Mahler. We think now of Gustav Mahler, but I think Max Reger would have been a real competitor. Max Reger is also famous for the most often repeated, not totally polite, commentary on music critics. He was hounded by critics who didn't like his music and said so openly. And clearly it annoyed him no end. He's famous for having written one critic that he was reading his criticism in the privacy of his bathroom. It was now in front of him, but soon would be behind him. He was an organist, and he was a man of large appetites. He was a big fellow, a fantastic organist by all accounts, and also very inspiring teacher, very inspiring teacher. And his pupils, his students revered him, among them Adolf Busch, the father-in-law of Rudolf Serkin, Otmar Schuck, the Swiss composer. And he represented a kind of line of composition that can be traced back to Beethoven, a kind of belief in Mendelssohn and Schumann. Although he's harmonically very advanced, his approach to musical time and to compositional structure is tied to the tradition that involves Brahms, a kind of what I would call the anti-Wagnerian set, although he is much influenced by the rhetoric, the musical rhetoric. The difference between the Brahmsians and Wagnerians is not as great as they thought it was. But Reger was a person who believed in the tradition, the historical tradition, that train that he felt himself on. And that involved paying attention to Baroque, classical, and early Romantic models. So his music, both his liturgical music and his instrumental music, shows a tremendous engagement with the past. He wrote several sets of variations. So variation form is at the heart of what Haydn and Mozart and the classical and Beethoven believed to be the craft of musical thinking. But musical thinking, if you want to know how composers think, variation form, even with Bach, with the Goldberg variations. And later, Beethoven famously, the Diabelli variation, the Eroica variations, the variations, for example, in the last movement of the Eroica symphony, on the creatures of Prometheus, that how you can have a dialogue with the audience by which an idea gets turned around, transformed, camouflaged, reinvented, and still it's related. And the idea of a thematic development and transformation. These kinds of skills add to that the skills, what we call counterpoint, of, so a linear skill and a horizontal skill, which is harmony, and a linear skill, which would be polyphony. Reger was really interested in the craft of composition, as was Spohr, by the way. The two composers you'll hear today are the masters of the craft of composition, Spohr and Reger. There's nothing they couldn't do with music. They had a kind of skill of transformation of materials, thinking musically. They were virtuosos in thinking in musical terms. In Reger's case, he wrote fantastic variations on themes by Mozart, by Hiller, and by Beethoven. Beethoven is from a bagatelle, not, again, a piece we don't now associate with Beethoven as a major emblem of Beethoven, but was popular in the days when the audience was primarily made of amateur players who played keyboard. And it is a kind of display of compositional transformation. So he takes this theme of Beethoven and he creates his own composition. And that's in the early 20th century. So those are the three responses to Beethoven we have on the stage. And then just out of a feeling that if we're going to have anniversaries, we don't need to remember people we have not forgotten. So Beethoven has not been forgotten. His works are not underrepresented. I have a terrible fear of 2027 when we're going to celebrate the 200th anniversary of his death. We barely have recovered from this year. So the question is, do anniversaries make sense? And I think they do. So this is being the 2019-2020 season. I thought, well, is there a composer who was born in 100 years ago, 200 years ago, either 1919 or 1920 or 1819 or 1820, that we should remember whom we actually have forgotten, or perhaps we never knew about? And top of my list was Galina Uslovskaya. So Galina Uslovskaya was one of the great talents, compositional talents, of the Soviet period in Russia. And clearly the greatest woman composer of her time in Russia. And she appears only, if anybody has ever heard of her, because she was a student of Shostakovich's and was a love interest of some kind, which nobody ever knows, which she vigorously denied. The truth of the matter is that she didn't like Shostakovich, at least if you believe what she says at the end of her life, toward the end of her life, and she didn't feel she had much in common with the music. We'll let you decide whether that's the case, because this is a relatively early piece. The reason we're doing it is there's very little music left by her that she authorized. She was very prolific, very energetic composer, but she banned or destroyed most of her music and left only about under 30 pieces that she thought were good enough to be out in the public view. If only every composer had exercised such self-restraint, our life would be a lot easier. But it's a shame to think what music. Brahms also destroyed a lot of his own music at the age of 60 that he didn't want to be left around after he died. So this is relatively early, but she approved of this work and she kept it in her catalog. She's an extremely powerful and idiosyncratic voice. You see in this concerto already. So I thought this is a person we need to remember that we don't think about and would be the 100th anniversary of her birth. And more of her music should be played. We did a piece earlier this season with the Tone Orchestra up at the Fisher Center, For Carnegie Hall, we decided to do the piano concerto from 1946, which is in a sonata form. It's a one continuous work. There's something Beethovenian about it. The gestures of the music are, there's a little bit of a nod to the Baroque. There's a nod to the Beethovenian use of the piano. Also a modernist, you can say it's a very modern work in the sense of the sonority. The piano is both a lyrical and a percussive instrument in this piece. It's for string orchestra and timpani. A more modernist, modern 20th century combination. It's a terrific piece, very dramatic, and I thought that fits on a, this is sort of a silly thing to think about, but Beethoven would have liked it. That if one were to celebrate his birth, I think one thing that would be important is musical art continuing, so to celebrate someone from a succeeding generation. And she needs remembering, and so why not smuggle her in under the umbrella of the overexposed Beethoven. Was she inspired by Beethoven? I don't think there's a single composer in her generation or in previous generation that wasn't. There's something you can't get out of your mind. The invention of music as a dramatic medium, a medium of telling a dramatic story without words. I mean, you cannot imagine the amount of speculation that has been dumped on the sonatas of Beethoven and the symphonies and the quartets in terms of what the story they're telling. And so people used to make fun of that. You know, fate knocking on the door, bah, 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 you know, that kind of thing. Well, it's not to be made fun of. There's a reason people think they're being told something, because the music actually does have that in mind. Czerny, who was a student of Beethoven's, used to say that Beethoven considered a narrative, a storyline, a scaffolding. You erected it to build the building, right? Then you took it down and nobody remembered it was there. It was a necessary transition from the linguistic to the musical. And the audience gets it. The audience sees that something, no, in the Pastoral Symphony, there's something of a story. But the music, the idea of music as being more than a formal exercise, but in the secular, it always was the case in religious music, but in secular music, where it begins to make an argument, an emotional, political, a personal argument, where the voice of the composer as a distinctive individual voice is put forward. And that sense of music as a medium you hear in the Osvolskaya, in the Liszt, in the Reger, and in the Spohr. I hope you enjoy yourself. Thank you very much.